Hi, everybody. I'm Mac Cheater. I'm an alcoholic. I would like to, first of all, thank the committee for inviting me here. This has been a delightful experience, and I've enjoyed every minute of it. I've enjoyed meeting people, and I've enjoyed my host and hostess that have been looking after me so well, and meeting people that I've met elsewhere, and so glad that little deal in Denver did some good, and that there are people here who are doing something about their lives. All I can do tonight is to share my experience, strength, and hope with you, and I hope that it might help somebody that's here. And I do belong to a group called the Golden Slippers, and I'm glad that I met some slippers here. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous on the 12th of March, 1956, and haven't had to have a drink since. And so, I never did slip after I got here. I slipped before I got here. And I've heard a lot of people say there's no such thing as a slipper. Well, you call it what you will. They say that nobody slips, it's a premeditated drunk. And I don't know what you're supposed to do with those people. Were you supposed to take them out and shoot them or what? But it always seemed to me that when life gets too much for an alcoholic, they sometimes drink booze. And sometimes we get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and we get so damn pious we forget that. And so I don't think you're supposed to distinguish whether somebody's been around or not. You know, I at one time would go 50 miles to make a 12-step call on a total stranger. And the next day I'd be on Copy Row saying, God, I did a hell of a job last night. And then somebody in my own group would phone up and I wouldn't walk across the street to see them. You say, God, they know where to go, you know. If they really wanted this thing, they wouldn't be drinking. And then all of a sudden I realized, you know, how easy it is to slip into that blissful state of piousness and forget what they smell like. And God, well, I hope I never get that way again. And one night I got a phone call on a Saturday night from a guy that I had been calling on for a long time, and he kept on drinking, and he just didn't want this thing bad enough. You know, he was dying. And we make a lot of judgments. But anyway, old Cliff phoned me, and he said, Mac, I'm sorry to bother you, because it's Saturday night, and I know you don't like to go out, but I call everybody else I knew, and I really need help. And nobody will come. So I picked up another guy that was slipping around and took old Ross, and we went to see Cliff. And I didn't know it, but Ross drank some of Cliff's booze while I was there. And those two guys were drinking, I was sober. And they convinced me that we should have breakfast together the next morning at my expense. And I went along with that, and I met them early the next morning, and we had breakfast, and they said if somebody would just take us and lead us through the program the way you've done with other people, we wouldn't have to drink. God, that made me feel good. I was the guy that could just do that, and so I said, well, hell, get a place and we'll start a meeting. And then they said, but if we start a meeting, everybody's going to come. And then they weren't paying any attention to us. And so I said, well, have a meeting at a time when nobody wants to come. So they said, how about 7 o'clock Sunday morning? I talked them into making it. Finally, we get down to 8:30, I think it was, and up until this year, we've been meeting at 8:30 Sunday morning ever since. This year, we moved it to 9. And you know, when we had the discussion about changing the time, that Cliff said, God, don't make it too late because I have to go to church at 11 o'clock. He's sober. And Ross is sober. And a lot of other people are sober. And you know what we do in that group? We do the steps. We read the big book. And we got that from you people. That's where it came from. It didn't come from up there. It came from down here someplace. Big book didn't come from Canada. But we use it. And we thank you for it. I was brought up on a farm, a little country town, and I was raised in a good Christian home. And my buddy Joe from Tyler, Texas says that Christian homes are just a breeding ground for alcoholics. And I never heard anybody get up here and say they came from a bad Christian home. But as I look back on my childhood and my upbringing, I can find nothing in my life that would in any way lead me to do the things I did. I was taught in the best of homes the difference between right and wrong, and I went to Sunday school and I went to church, and I was brought up with all the love and the kindness and the concern that you could possibly have. I never did without anything. I never lived in hardship. Worked hard. During the Depression years, everybody worked hard. I went in the Army in the early part of the war. Went overseas in 1941, spent 5.5 years in the armed services, spent a little longer than I was supposed to because I didn't come home when I was supposed to, because I was a full-blown alcoholic, and I had started drinking when I was 15 years of age, and the Army just, you know, opened the door. It just made it legal to do the things I was doing. And, you know, it was a damn poor soldier that couldn't drink a little. And nobody looked down on us, and it was the thing to do. We had a wet canteen. It was, you were supposed to go in there. And I did. But I was a proud soldier, and I worked hard, and I was commissioned in England and became an officer. And I was proud of that. And if I do say so myself, I was a damn good soldier. And I loved it. And we went to France and we fought, and I loved that. I was the only unhappy guy in the Canadian Army when the war stopped. Because you know what was going to happen to me? I was going to come back and be a nothing again. And that's exactly what happened. I come home and I was a nothing again. I was a hero for a couple of days, but by the time I got home, that hero stuff had worn off. Because I kept missing the boat. And I was all ready to come home, and I meant to come home, and all my stuff came home. My trunk arrived. And my family had a sign on the front of our home, "Welcome home, son." God, by the time I got there, it was faded. It was just been worn out. I'd get drunk and go and leave and then come back two or three days late, the boat would have gone, and they'd put me on another draft, and it wouldn't be going for 3 weeks. They'd say, well, you might as well take some leave, and I'd stay too long, and I'd miss that boat. And it took me from November to February to make a boat. I just got tired. Came home. After I came home, I went to school, and in a few months, I prepared myself for university, and everybody was going to university, and so it didn't make much sense to me that I should get in that mob and go to university, and besides, I knew I'd never make it. I was drinking too much. I used to go on weekends and get back to school on Wednesday, and I tried, and I worked hard at school. I wrote a lot of subjects in a short period of time. I couldn't tell you what I did. Now, when you do it that fast, it doesn't last very long, but just last long enough to get the test over with. And I can remember on Monday morning, I have to go and check into a hotel and get straightened around for get back to school as quick as I could. That'd take me to Wednesday. And then, hell, you only had Thursday and Friday. And the weekend would start again. 1946, my grandfather took ill. They thought he was going to die and called all the family home. And a member of our family was a psychiatrist who at that time, I believe, was living in Cleveland. He became a professor of psychiatry at Cleveland University. I recall sitting on our front steps and him telling me about this fellowship that had started, one drunk helping another drunk, called Alcoholics Anonymous. That was the first thing I'd ever heard about Alcoholics Anonymous, and it just didn't impress me too much. I thought he was enthused, and I could see where, from his occupation, his profession, that he'd be enthused about something like that, but, you know, it was just conversation. But it's funny, it stuck in my mind. Number of years later, as a matter of fact, it'd be about 15 years later, I went to his home in Cleveland, and I asked him if he recalled that conversation, and he said he did. And I said, did you have anything in mind for me that night? And he said, yes, I did. And it never occurred to me. It really never occurred to me. I did some reading about Alcoholics Anonymous, and then I drank with some people that found Alcoholics Anonymous. One of them was Cecil, and Cecil was long overdue for Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was just not a good drinker. He was slovenly, and he wore overalls, and, you know, he was a bum, one of my buddies, and so Cecil went away and joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and got sober, and everybody loved him. And they made a big fuss about Cecil getting sober, and I thought, why the hell would they help him? He's a drunk, and they wouldn't help me. And I resented the hell out of him. And then he'd come, and we'd sit down and have coffee, and he'd tell me how good things were going for him. And every day they were getting worse for me. So I knew Cecil, and I knew that he was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew that he was making some progress in life. We belonged to, at least I belonged to a club at that time called the Kinsman Club, and Cecil wanted to belong to that club. He tried several times, and they blackballed him, and I could understand why. But I did sponsor him into the Kinsman Club. And I often tell him it was harder for me to get him into that club than it was for him to get me into Alcoholics Anonymous. My drinking, of course, progressed like everybody else's did. I never heard anybody stand up here and say things got better when they were drinking. It got worse. And my wife, God bless her, lived in a total state of confusion because of the erratic behavior and the lies and the the way I had to live. I had a pretty good business at one time, and at one time in that town I was the up-and-coming young businessman. I can remember about 5 years before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, how I could walk down the street and prominent businessmen would shake my hand and pat me on the back and tell me what a comer I was, and I can remember them trying to get me to allow my name to stand for political parties. I can remember the gentleman that became our prime minister at one time, John Diefenbaker. I spent several hours in his office one day. He tried to convince me I should run for politics. 5 years later, I couldn't get a job in that town. 5 years later, I walked down the street and nobody talked to me. 5 years later, there wasn't a person in that town who cashed a check of mine. And I didn't write bad checks. I just wrote some that were slower than others. It was just a matter of timing. It was like the drunk that said, what time is it? And somebody told him, he said, hell, I didn't mean, you know, what time of day. Is it winter time or summertime? But you see, things just got to the point where I couldn't stand it anymore, and I'd quit drinking 1,000 times. I always quit drinking at the worst times. Did you ever have that experience? I remember one day I quit drinking and I meant it as short as I stand here. I quit drinking and I just knew that I would never have to take another drink, and then all of a sudden I remembered we were having a party for a guy that was leaving town that night and was at our house. And I just panicked. Because everybody would notice. And what would they think of me if I didn't have a drink? And then I conceived a tremendous plan. I would just be such a busy and perfect host that nobody would notice. I just make sure everybody else had a drink and look after everybody, and they'd never notice. They'd think I was drinking, but they wouldn't know. And so I went home and I got everything ready. I was ready for that party about 5 o'clock. And because I got all ready, my wife got ready. And God, she come down all dressed for the party, and it'd be 7 o'clock in the evening. And she looked at her watch and she said, God, we're early enough. Why don't we have a drink while we're waiting? And I said to her, my God, woman, do you have to be drinking all the time? You can't even wait for the party to start. And that poor girl never took more than 3 drinks in a night in her life. She is a legitimate social drinker. And they're terrible. I always like to tell people that I was a social drinker. I used to always be a social drinker until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's why when those yahoos in New York decided that they could make alcohol or make social drinkers out of alcoholics, it confused me. Because you see, I damn near died social drinking. And since I became an alcoholic, I haven't had to have a drink. And I would far rather be an alcoholic and stay sober than to be a social drinker and die. So they can have that deal. I never was an alcoholic until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But my wife was a social drinker, still is. And I watch her and it's a painful thing. Someday I hope society will do something in the way of research to try to find out about social drinkers. You watch them pour an ounce of whiskey in a glass, and then they put ice in it, and they fill it up with 7-Up, and they sit there and they suck on it for an hour and a half, and the ice melts, and they go put some more in it, and they say, God, isn't this good? I've got my mother-in-law trained. She runs around the room, says, hurry up, Mac, doesn't like you to take too much time drinking. Get it done. So she asked me one time if it bothered me, and I said, sure as hell does. It just pains me to see you work on booze that way. So you see, I was not a success. I came to hear a total failure in every part of my life. And the day that I phoned Cecil and asked for help, I was a crying, babbling idiot. I had quit drinking that morning, too. And I had gone a couple of hours. And I just couldn't go any longer. And I went and I had a beer. And I don't know what happened that day because I was in a beer parlor. We didn't have bars then. You people did, but we didn't. We had beer parlors. And I don't know what happened to me, but I know that that place was full of people and they were all yelling at me.
Well,
and I guess
a short time after he died, the hospital asked me to listen to me if he wanted an update on the progress of the organ recipient. But back then, all things were over well. We were both still in the fog. And
he just couldn't see the rest of them.
I just didn't know what to deal with it.
And I did leave, and I went in the box of booze, and I checked in over
there. And when the hairdresser told me her story.
And that's where I was when I phoned for help.
Well,
and I was crying.
This is not alone.
And I was a totally defeated person. And I called for help because I didn't know what else to do. And I hope that I never forget that day. I never forget the
Blame
day
the
that I had to pick
panicking.
Up the phone and phone
she felt
for help.
She didn't dare admit she was on the merry-go.
And I hope that I never forget to go when somebody phones me.
Around here at this hour.
Because it's kind of easy.
Well, will you look?
It's kind of easy.
Yeah, get my sunglasses.
4 o'clock in the morning, say, well, what happened? You phone somebody
else. I have to cash a check. Could you let me have 50?
And Cecil came.
You
want, and Cecil phoned my wife.
The lucky girl.
I got somebody here that's 45 years old.
Rita
Bradford.
I mean,
she said you might as well
Rita
bring myself,
the divorce held up. Well, she came to my office to consult me professionally this afternoon. After all, it's a year and a half in her life.
She didn't have
part out.
And if you can't help her, we capture her.
We
pet.
Couldn't even get in the hospital. Mm-hmm.
At least I can do some right now for future.
But the doctor came up to my home and he treated me and he brought one of those bottles and he put a needle in my arm and the guy had to stand and hold it. Because there's nothing to hook it on.
So you're the new Chris Nandler.
It was some kind of a solution. It was supposed to make me feel better. I kept saying, if you just give me a drink, I'd be okay. Finally, he said, you might as well give him one. I remember that. I remember waking up the next morning and Cecil was sitting in the room. And he said to me, are you really serious about joining Alcoholics Anonymous? And I thought, holy hell, I've done it this time. Well, I wasn't in a position to argue, I'll tell you. I said, oh yeah, I'm serious. And I thought, God, how can I get out of this? And then I remembered phoning him. And it was all very confusing, and they kept coming. One guy would come, and another guy would go, and I remember one guy was a great friend of mine in Cesus. He came and he sat there. And this was about the third day when Elmer got there. I was trying to negotiate some poached eggs. And he looked at me and then he said something very wise. He said, are you not feeling too well? Well, I thought I'd hit about the brightest bunch of people I'd ever met in my life. And I said, I have to get to work, and they said, no, you don't. I told my wife to phone my boss and tell him I had the flu. And she did that. Our home had to be sold, pay off my debts. It didn't pay off my debts, but it paid off the ones that would have put me in jail. We had a little boy and a little girl. An uncle of mine and my sister came and took them away. And we moved into a little basement room in another city, 150 miles away. And That's called ego deflation at death. Because I could not support my family. And that's how I started in Alcoholics Anonymous. And sometimes when people come up to me and say nice things like, you know, when you get to be a trustee, they call you Big Shot. And I think of that. I wish they could have seen that apartment I had. You know, people would phone up and say, we're in town. We wondered if we could come over and see you. And we'd say, where are you? We'll meet you. And we were ashamed to let anybody see where we lived. And one day, a fellow and his wife got through, and they just came to the door. And for some reason, we've never seen them since. They weren't impressed with us. So you see, you stand up here and you joke and you tell funny things and you laugh, and that's a good thing, but this is a serious business. And it's a long, rocky road. And I will be forever grateful for those people that came and sat with me and led me into this program and taught me the things to do. I will be forever grateful for the old-timers that were hard rocks. God, they were hard rocks. And they just scared the hell out of me. And they told me what I had to do, and I never argued with them. There was no backtalk. And I just wrote to the daughter of one fellow that he was 63 when he got sober, and he was 84 when he died. And old Dave, he was something else. And they told me to read the big book. And they told me that that was the only thing to read. And I read it. And every time I had a problem, they told me to quit feeling sorry for myself. I never forget one day I was cutting the lawn. This was after I had made some progress. We got into a house, and a fella come along, and then I was sponsoring. He was in his 60s, and I was busy. So I said, "Go over and see Ed and see what he has to say about your problem." And a few minutes later, I saw Ken coming down the street, and he's mad. And I could tell a block and a half away he was mad. And I said, "What did Ed tell you to do?" He said, "What did he tell me to do? What did he tell me to do?" He said, "Read the book, read the book, read the book. That's all anybody tells me to do." But that was the standard answer, and it worked. By God, if you want to know, I just told somebody tonight, read the book. Because that's where it's at. You see, Alcoholics Anonymous has a program of recovery. It does not have a program of sobriety. This is a program of recovery, and it just happens to be the only program of recovery there is in the world today. And that any place else you might go that doesn't lead you to the door of Alcoholics Anonymous is doomed to fail. And never forget that you can recover from alcoholism in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that it's like swearing in church to stand up here and tell you I'm a recovered alcoholic. But you see, I can no longer hang any of my bitchiness on my alcoholism. If I'm a rotten SOB today, it's just because I'm a rotten SOB, and it's got nothing to do with alcoholism. My God, I'm about as dry as I'm ever going to get. And there is nothing wrong with being well. I am a well human being. God, there's nothing wrong with that. But let me tell you how it used to be. You see, when I was a kid and I was brought up in that good home, I used to get sick occasionally. I'd get earache, and I had tonsillitis and things like that. And I could stay home from school, and they would mother me all day. I could stay in bed, and they'd bring my breakfast up to me, and they'd read to me, and God, it was nice. And later on in life, when things got rough, I used to say to myself, God, I wish I could be sick. And then I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and the first thing you told me was I was sick. How lovely that was. I told my wife, I'm a sick man. I told my banker. He was germ friend. He said, I know you're sick. He said, I'd appreciate it if you stayed out of this bank. Even if you got money, don't come back here. But you see, I wanted to dwell in the illness. It was comfortable to be sick. It was an excuse for everything. It was the alibi I'd been looking for. You know, I could quit work at 2 in the afternoon and go and sleep because I needed my rest. I was not well. And then it said in the book, you know, it has a beautiful thing in the book. It has an out for those of us who want to stay sick. It says, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. So you can stay sick if you want. You don't have to get well. You can roam around in Alcoholics Anonymous for years and be sick. But there's really not much point to it. Why don't you just give in and get well? And if you want to get well, you just do the simple things you're supposed to do. There's no mystery about it. And you know, isn't it great what society is doing? You know that alcoholism is the biggest killer in the world today. You know that more people will die from alcoholism in Colorado Springs in the next 12 months than any other single illness. And I was just reading in our current grapevine that Seagram's, those good Canadian people, hey, yeah, they've donated just under $6 million, $5,800,000 to one of your universities. I think it's Harvard, the medical school. And they're going to research and find out how come some people are alcoholic and some aren't. Hell, with 2 bottles of whiskey, we can find that out. All you got to do is give them a bottle. And the alcoholic will pick the top off and throw it away. Social drinker, a poor drink, put top back on. You meet one of those people and they say, would you like a drink? You say, no thanks. Because you know that's what they mean. A drink. You ever go out in the evening and play bridge and somebody say, would you like a drink? And you say, no thanks. What the hell would you want one drink for? But they're gonna spend that money. And there's all kinds of that going on in our society. All kinds of it. And we have a program that promises recovery from alcoholism, and I think it's time we stood up and told them. Because they don't know. And they're trying to find out. And I think we have an obligation to tell people whenever we can. I was on a program not long ago, and they had one of the city, our city aldermen that represented the city. And he was taking the mayor's place because the mayor didn't want to come in case, you know, we signed him up. And so they sent his alderman, and he got up, and he said that the city was not responsible for the treatment of alcoholism. It was our province that should do that. He said they make all the profit on alcohol. They sell alcohol, and our government, our provincial government, run all our liquor stores. So they make all that profit, and they publish the figures, and they make billions of dollars every year on the booze business, and he said that there's no reason in the world why they shouldn't take some of that money and put it into the treatment of alcoholism. And I was the next speaker. And I said, you know, we elected that idiot. You know? He's going to treat alcoholism by selling booze to the alcoholics and making money and then treat them, you know. God, doesn't that make a lot of sense? So we're not going to get a lot of help from those people. And people are dying by the thousands. Alcoholism in North America, if not all over the world, is in epidemic proportions. And we like to talk about the million people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Hell, they're making them faster than we can get to them. And if you have a problem with any treatment center or anything, don't worry about them because there's enough to go around. Some of us at Alcoholics Anonymous get all upset because somebody tries to treat people. Well, hell, they can't hurt them. Nobody in this world would hurt me as much as I hurt myself. If they planned it, they couldn't do it. And they'll come here eventually. Alcoholism is a terrible, terrible illness. Let's never forget it. I have a mind and a body that's different than normal. I have a mind and a body that never changes. I am mentally and bodily different from my fellows. And thank God, I have a body that is different than normal or I wouldn't be here. And most of you wouldn't be here. An alcoholic is a body that can withstand abuse like nothing else in God's green earth. You take an alcoholic, comes out 3 weeks drunk, and you get him dried out, and he looks like he come back from holiday. Walks down the street all dressed up, looking real good. Been sober 3 days. We are not inferior. You know, I used to read that in a big book saying that we were bodily and mentally different, and I thought that meant we were inferior. Well, hell. And we best not talk about the mental part. We give a lot of people that are not alcoholic an inferiority complex. You couldn't survive if you weren't a little bit ahead of those people. You know? You just couldn't. I mean, you didn't go to an alcoholic to cash check, did you? I have a body that cannot handle alcohol. And I don't know why, it just doesn't work. I have a body that if I put alcohol into it, does something to it that is different. And that's where I have a problem with the people that talk about addiction. Hell, my body rejected alcohol. If my body could have handled alcohol, I probably wouldn't be here. But you see, my body couldn't handle alcohol, and at the same time, I had a mind that compelled me to drink. So I was in what Bill called a nutcracker. I just either had to get sober or go crazy or die. Because it just will not work. And that's the way I am, and that's the way I was then, and that's the way I am today, and that's the way I'll always be. And when I talk about recovery, I'm not saying there's a cure. But if you don't drink and do the steps in this program, you'll recover. And you'll be well. And you'll have a head start on the rest of the world. And you'll learn to enjoy life. I could stand up here tonight and just tell you things that have happened to me that about the joy of living that we talked about in New Orleans. And
we enjoy life so much in Alcoholics Anonymous. We learn to love each other and to enjoy. And if you're out there tonight and you're feeling bad because you don't want to be an alcoholic and you're afraid you might be, let me tell you something, that it's the greatest thing that ever happened to you and could possibly happen to you. If I ever get a chance to talk at a Gratitude Day and talk about gratitude in Alcoholics Anonymous, the thing that I am most grateful for and always will be the pain of alcoholism that brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. The pain that God put in my life that brought me to where I am is the thing I'm most grateful for. I just, every week, I see situations and I see people and I think, my God, if they were just alcoholic, we could do something for them. There was a guy in the treatment business named Lefty Anderson used to say, excuse me, old Lefty used to say, I'm an alcoholic and I know what my problem is, what's yours? And, but that's true, we are blessed people. We are people who are given something that is beyond our wildest imagination. Alcoholics Anonymous is a way of life that is described in the big book as indescribable, indescribably wonderful. And there's no way that anybody can stand up here and tell you how wonderful Alcoholics Anonymous is because you can't describe it. You just have to live it one day at a time and enjoy it. Now there's maybe somebody out there tonight that wonders whether they're alcoholic or not. Let me tell you something. If you're not alcoholic, you don't wonder about it. It just doesn't cross your mind. And we've never had a case of somebody getting in here that shouldn't be here. We've never had to kick anybody out. But we always have a lot of people that should be here trying to get out. Before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, couldn't keep a job. Not long ago, I had to fire a guy. And I said to him, I want you to remember what this feels like. Because I've sat in the chair you're sitting in many times. I've been fired every way you can be fired. I've had everything told to me, all the cliches, you know, like I don't think you're suited for this business. Or the one I used to read it like was, this is going to hurt me more than it's going to hurt you. God, you know, I used to stay out of hell with it, mainly my check. And I had to fire this guy, and I told him. And then when I got finished, I said, now I'm going to get your job. And I picked up the phone, and I phoned the guy in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got him a job. And he wasn't meant for our business. But he was a good boy, and he was meant for somebody's business. He's just in the wrong business. But you see, I've never had to look for a job since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a job when I came here, and they were going to fire me. And I just happened to get here at the right time. I had enough time before they were going to fire me that it was 3 months. By the time that 3 months was up, they decided to keep me. And I worked another 2 years for them before I left them. And I've never had to look for a job. And that's something that I cannot deny that's happened to me. Now you see, it's not good enough to find out that you're alcoholic and what that means, but this program happens to be a spiritual program. And I'd like to just caution some of you people that are into these study groups and that Remember, it's spiritual, not academic. And that's hard not to get too enthused and start lecturing. But I've done that. You become an expert. And if it's spiritual, then it's necessary for us to come to some kind of an understanding about a God of our own understanding. And that's something that I cannot deny that's happened to me. Now you see, it's not good enough to find out that you're alcoholic and what that means, but this program happens to be a spiritual program. And I'd like to just caution some of you people that are into these study groups and that remember it's spiritual, not academic. And that's hard not to get too enthused and start lecturing. But I've done that. You become an expert. And if it's spiritual, then it's necessary for us to come to some kind of an understanding about a God of our own understanding, a power greater than ourselves. And I want to talk just a little bit about that, because it's so hard, it's so difficult to come to grips with this God business. You know, it's so complicated. It's so complicated to make a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God until you find out what's running your life. Then it's a lead pipe cinch. I don't know about anybody here, but I had trouble with buses. Ever drive down the street and notice how the buses cut you off? You know, those guys have a big bloody bus and they think they own the street and they're licensed by the city and they don't care whether they obey the traffic laws or not, and they just cut you right off. And it doesn't hurt, doesn't do any good to yell at them. But I just don't like buses. And they always stop wherever they want to stop, and they don't know that you're behind and they're blocking the lane and you're in a hurry and they're not. And it comes to be a sad day when you realize that a bus is running your life. You drive for half an hour talking to buses. Then you go to the meeting and say, if I'm not going to manage my life, who's going to? Well, if they knew, they'd say the bus is. You ever go into your office and find a message saying your banker called you? And right away you're saying, I wonder what he wants. And you try to recall the last time a banker phoned you and said, you got too much money in my bank. And the banker's running your life. Ever have a traffic light turn red when you're in a hurry? You sit there drumming away, say, what the hell did I turn red now for? And a traffic light is running your life. So you see, after a while, you find out, at least I did, that I never ran my life. From the time I got up till I went to bed, something was running my life. Something like bankers, buses, traffic lights, collection agencies. God, I hate collection agencies. I had a fellow working for me, and one day I got a phone call about him. Guy, I said, who's calling? He said, a collection agency. Man, did I tell him off. When my employee came in, I said, I think you're in trouble. I said, that collection agency phoned me and I think he's mad at you. But you see, these were the things that ran my life. All my life I was buffeted by people, by things, by circumstance. And then I came to you and you said I had to turn my will and my life over to a power greater than myself. Well, it's really not that hard to do. It was mentioned last night. The book that says either God is or he isn't. That's pretty tough, isn't it? Either he is or he isn't. When you were drinking, did you sit around with your fellow intellectuals and discuss isn'ts? I didn't. We discussed and solved international problems. They hadn't started flying around the moon then, or we'd have settled all those problems. But we sure didn't talk about isn'ts. And then it says he's either everything or he's nothing. Well, you didn't sit around and talk about nothing, did you? Even when you're talking to yourself, you didn't talk about nothing. When somebody come along and you're sitting on a bar stool and you're talking to yourself and they said, what'd you say? You didn't say what I said, nothing. You always talked about something. He's either everything or he's nothing. If you want to see God, look around you. It's here. It's all over the place. It's everything. Everything is everything. He's here in this room tonight. You can't help but see God if you look in the eyes of a sober drunk, of a sober alcoholic. A friend of mine couldn't stay sober. He came to Alcoholics Anonymous, kept right on drinking, and finally, after many years, he got sober. He's walking down the street one day, and a very prominent doctor in our town stopped him and said, Frank, do you mind if I ask you a question? And Frank said, not at all. And the doctor said to him, Frank, how come you're so happy? Frank said, Doctor, as I look around from where we stand, nearly every building I see you own. You're one of the most successful people in this town. I don't even have the proverbial pot. What makes you think I'm happy? And he said, Frank, I can see it in your eyes. You can't deny that, can you? And if you're having trouble with the God business, just pretend. Just act as though you believe. And do the things you're supposed to do in that book, and it'll work. Nobody's going to give you a test except life itself. And if you will try the God experiment in your life, you might always want to argue about the experiment, but you cannot deny the experience. And you will experience things in your life that you cannot deny. See, I went to old Cecil after I'd been sober a little while, and I said, Cecil, there's an awful lot of God in this program, and they're throwing religion at me. And he said, Mac, how long have you been sober? And I told him, it must have been 2 months. And he said, how many years has it been since you went that long without at least one drink? And I could not honestly recall how many years it had been. And then he said, do you think you did it all by yourself? And I knew that I didn't have the power within myself to stay sober that long. I could not deny what was happening to me. Something was keeping me sober, and I was experiencing sobriety in my life, and I couldn't argue about it. I couldn't deny it. So you don't have to be a genius. You just have to be honest enough to say, I couldn't stay sober by myself, and I'm sober. There's something working in my life. And it'll work. You can't stop it. If you do the things you're supposed to do, and you think you're having trouble, a few years ago on Time magazine, there was a front cover that said, God is dead. And where'd that come from? That came from a clergyman. Because he had found out what had happened to his race during the Second World War, and he couldn't conceive of a God letting that happen. And so rather than deny the existence of God, he said, God must be dead. And one night I was going to a meeting, and I saw a bumper sticker on the back of a car, and it said, my God isn't dead, sorry but yours. Then I thought some drunk wrote that. But you see, drunks don't have an exclusive on the problem of God. Clergymen have problems too. If you stick around, don't drink, you'll find your God. I wish I could stand up here tonight and tell you that all your life is going to be good if you stay sober. But I can tell you it's not going to be. Because we don't have a free ride. We don't have an easy life just because we stopped drinking. A friend of mine went to his group one night and got a medallion for 1 year sobriety. He went home and he said, showed it to his father. His father said, what'd you get that for? He said, I haven't had a drink for a year. He said, hell, I never drank all my life and nobody gave me a medal. You see, life is not an easy thing. I told you we had two children, we did. We had a boy and a girl. And we got them back in time, and our family grew so close. Our life was Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, our home was full of drunks all the time. And our kids grew up with drunks around them. Somebody came to our home that was not an Alcoholics Anonymous, they didn't give them 2 minutes. They'd go and play someplace, but if they were in AA, they'd sit and listen. One day I stood in the doctor's office and I heard him say our son had cancer. And he said, we're already fighting for his life. Within 2 weeks, he had a leg amputated. A year later, the cancer recurred in his lungs. And he went through 3 lung operations. And within 2 years, our boy died. People said to me, did you ever think of taking a drink? My God, if I was ever grateful for sobriety, it was during those times. Because of you people, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, that boy knew he could phone me at 4 o'clock in the morning and I'd get up and go to the hospital and we'd sit and talk. And we talked about the purpose of life and the purpose of death. One night he came home. He said to me, if there was a time machine that would take me back to what I was, I wouldn't take it. Because I've come to know God of my own understanding. I'm able to go to him in prayer at night. And I'm at peace with myself. And that boy died in peace. That boy died a man. When I was trying to teach him how to live, he taught me how to die. Before he died, he went and bought me a Christmas present. My wife gave it to me after the funeral. That present is a medallion. On one side of it is the word Dad, on the other side are the words thanks for being here. And that happened to a drunk that couldn't support his family. Because of you people, I was there when he needed me. 2 years later, I was sitting in the living room one night. My wife said to me, I've got something to tell you. The hardest thing about this whole deal is telling you, because she said, I've got cancer. And so she had an operation, and so far, so good. I phoned her last night. She's fighting with her mother. They're both doing well. In February this year, I sat in the same living room with my daughter and my wife, and I said to them, hey, folks, I got something I got to tell you, because I've got cancer. And so I went to the hospital and I had an operation and I had a miraculous recovery. I only missed 18 days work. And they took half my bowel out. And they snipped me from my chest bone to my rectum. I said to that doctor, God, you give yourself enough room to work. He said I never was much for making ships and bottles. The other day he said to me, Mac, I think you're going to be one of our cures. I said, if I hadn't thought that, I wouldn't come to you in the first place. But you see, I had a head start because I told him right off the bat, nobody owes me a damn thing. I'm going to this thing and I can't lose. Because I've had it all before I got there. You see, you people in this life give me everything the person could have. I've had the whole ball of wax. I don't deserve anything, and I've been given everything. There's nothing more in this world a person could have. Last Saturday, I wasn't home, but we celebrated our 33rd wedding anniversary. That little gal, I've carried her all these years. I told her that. I phoned her and wished her, congratulated her. Said, I want to phone you and wish you a happy wedding anniversary. And she said, thank you very much. I said, why the hell didn't you phone me? It's mine too. But you see, our daughter's married, lives close to us. And we have a beautiful little grandson. First of all, they got a dog and they named it Mac. Then they had a little boy and they named him after me too. And one of the greatest things that could happen to me happened this summer. My son and I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. By God, on the 15th of September, he was sober 3 months. The worst thing about it is to keep my hands off it. I'd like to get in there and tell him how to do things, but I got him a guy that I sponsored and said, look after him and just make sure he gets all the right things. And he's doing great. So I have lots of love in my home, and because of you, I know that this does not end in this lifetime. I know that we don't live this thing in one world. I know when I thank you for a lifetime of sobriety, I'm talking about eternity. I know that I will walk with that boy again. I know that as surely as I stand here tonight. That is not a question of faith, it's a question of certain knowledge. I know that this thing goes on. I know that we have entered the world of the Spirit and it doesn't end in this life. And I hope that someday everybody will come to know that. So you see, living is part of dying and dying is part of living. And it's no big deal. We need to have no fear of life or no fear of death. We are surely safe in our Father's hand. There was a little guy that spoke here not many years ago, a guy by the name of Niles. And this year, just before I went to the hospital, I got a little letter from Niles. I'd written him. And Niles wrote me a note, and I've still got it because Niles died in Dallas this spring. Niles died when I was in the hospital, and Niles wrote in that note, my friend, we have done some good together. And that took me back to a time when I was a boy, when my grandmother gave me an autograph book, and somehow over the years I've kept that little book, and not long ago I was looking at it, and when she gave it to me, it was my 16th birthday, and she wrote a note in it, wrote an autograph. I don't know whether anybody else remembers those days or not, but those were the things we used to do. We used to get an autograph book and give them to people, and people would write verses to us, and we kept them, and I kept that book. And my grandmother had written this verse, and I'd like to close with that, because Niall said we have done some good together, and that verse said, do good and let who will be clever. Do noble deeds, not dream them all day long. And so make life, death, and the vast forever one grand sweet song. Thank you very much.